ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The Economy Stupid is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Today, as we continue to look back at some of your favourite stories, I want to know if your work day is actually a work night. Around 4 million Australians work between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. and that has its challenges, like finding healthy food, a public toilet that is open, or a train to get you home. How do our cities need to evolve to better serve our night shift workers? And as a former shift worker myself, just how bad is shift work for our health? Also ahead, a tiny bakery in Sydney is selling supposedly life-changing cinnamon scrolls, and the line of people eager to buy one stretches down the road and around the corner. So how does the act of queuing for hours to buy something increase the thrill of when you finally get it? Or does the wait mean you're destined for disappointment? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, ChatGPT, Grammarly, Google Gemini. AI tools have changed student life in the space of just a couple of years. Cheating seems easier than ever before, but it's hard for schools and universities to know how widespread the use of AI is and how to deal with it. A recent report from the University of New South Wales found 172 cases of plagiarism and misconduct at UNSW College. It's about one in every 12 students. Many schools have AI guidelines in place. Some ask students not to use AI, some allow AI in specific assignments. And AI detection tools are imperfect. Meanwhile, students say that monitoring and accusations of AI use can create more stress. With me is nursing student Mark McLaughlin, who never expected to be accused of unlawfully using AI when he submitted an essay, and then to spend 5 months fighting the accusation. Mark, tell me your story.
Oh, good morning. How are you going? So my experience started in first week of April, and we're now going on to, like you said, 5 months. Mm. And I guess there's the two factors to my case. One is that I was fighting to clear my name and have my academic misconduct record removed and receive the full marks that I was eligible for in my assignment. That part has been unsuccessful, and I have received an academic penalty on that assignment, but it still enabled me to pass the unit. So I've kind of moved on from that. I'm now, putting up a bigger battle for universities, education providers to provide a more student-focused approach to the allegations when they're made. So not throwing an allegation at a student and then dumping them and leaving them to deal with the emotional and the stress that comes with that allegation. Mm. So as part of mine, I've had three appeals through the university, very little communication with them over it. It's now, I have lawyers involved, I have my union involved, and this currently is with the National Student Ombudsman, who have issued my institution a letter for them to respond to, which they have 2 weeks from last Friday to respond, and that will hopefully include a mediation session where we can have some meaningful discussions on how they can support students through the process.
This sounds like it's been, if nothing else, a huge time suck for you, as well as, like you're saying, really stressful. Can you tell me what actually the crux, like what was the assignment? What happened?
So the crux of the assignment was that I was given an assignment and you had to compare and contrast two types of interventions for a particular scenario. One was a fairly old intervention and one's a new intervention. So how do we used to do things and how do we do things now? That was the assignment. The assignment was, for me, compiled and researched in the same way that I had researched every other assignment for the last 3 years, and that is with the tools given to us by Murdoch University, a set of guidelines on how to use those tools by Murdoch University. And then once I had done that and submitted it, that was then a few days later that I received an email from the unit coordinator saying, look, you've been flagged for AI, please do not contact me in bold writing. And then it's off with student integrity services for them to do the investigation. That was when I then, a few days later, received an email saying that they've I've been alleged of using artificial intelligence model based on a few of their, what they believe to be fairly robust criteria, which is what we're obviously, I'm alleging is not robust. And then from then on, I've now gone through to the third appeal. So it's been very time consuming. I've had to put in exam deferrals. I wasn't able to sit my exams at the same time as the rest of my cohort, which automatically adds another level of stress to you. When you, the process when you do a deferred exam is you only get one shot at the exam. Mm. If you fail the exam, then you fail the unit. Whereas if you sit at a normal time with the rest of the cohort, you get two attempts. So you kind of automatically add another level of stress straight away. So, yeah, so it's put kind of a few of those things on hold. Then, as you said, it's very, very time-consuming. It's been going on for 5 months, and I've had, you know, lots and lots of phone calls and discussions with external parties over how we can deal with this going forward and, you know, what is the problem and how are things working.
Am I right in thinking the tool that they're using to detect AI is, in fact, an AI tool?
So, interestingly enough, it wasn't until the very last communication that I received from the university, which was their final decision on my case, that said that this is from Student Integrity Services, so this is the department within the university that make these decisions, have noted there is no correct way to detect AI, and Student Integrity Services discourages the unit coordinators from using AI detectors. Firstly, because it means they are feeding the AI with work of students. The second, because those provide lots of false positives. Then they've gone on to say further on how they've assessed mine. A reliance on metadata can be problematic. For example, Word documents metadata may be unreliable indicator of editing behaviour. In this context, if metadata is used this way, students could be clearly advised to work within a single document throughout the drafting process, and to avoid renaming or moving the file, and the student could be at risk of being unfairly flagged and judged on the quality of their defence to allegations rather than the strength of the initial evidence. That's where I'm at the moment. So they're judging me on my defence, my legal defence, as opposed to their evidence of use of AI. So they don't have the tools to detect AI, and that's the issue.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Mark McLaughlin, who's a nursing student. His an assignment that he submitted was flagged for AI use by his university. He says he didn't use it and he's been embroiled in the appeal process ever since. And it really kind of sheds a light on the fact that the tools that are being used by some students and not by others, the tools used to detect AI in student assignments are imperfect. I'm asking you as well what you think the line is in terms of cheating. Mark's story completely to one side. Given that so many people are using AI in their work, is it fair to say that students aren't allowed to use it? Has the horse kind of bolted here? Markul says AI is part of life. There's no going back. Finding a pragmatic solution is the only way out. A different person says, in my opinion, yes, using AI is cheating. If people don't have to write their assignments, then how are they to learn to write well? My kids can't even read cursive writing, let alone do it. We're losing language capabilities due to technology. It's concerning to me. Well, with me also is Dr. Jasmine Thomas, who's an Associate Director of ICT Governance and Partnerships at the University of Southern Queensland, and Dr. Cameron Edmund, who's a lecturer in game development at Macquarie University's School of Computing. Jasmine, listening to Mark's experience, and what's your sort of reaction to that with your work?
I think that it's important to acknowledge that universities have a responsibility to uphold integrity, first and foremost. And as part of that, they operate within policies and regulation that ensures that procedural fairness needs to be built into any investigation that occurs with students. And often these investigations are also opportunities for student intervention, because when suspected academic misconduct arises, it can be emblematic of other issues. So perhaps a student is struggling, perhaps they need more support. And throughout the whole process, there are a range of student supports built in, because student safety is also university's number one priorities. So procedural fairness and the ability to deal with these complaints is just as important as how we are actually dealing with AI as well.
So we heard Mark say emphatically that he didn't use AI, but you are seeing it being used by students in schools and unis.
Oh, absolutely. And the UNSW report that you referred to reflects that as well. So in my former role, I was investigating these cases, and there is a huge range of ways that students may cheat, or also in terms of how obvious it is to pick out. I mean, for example, I've had assignments in the past that have literally had regenerate response included down the bottom, or it has included the preamble from ChatGPT. Sure, I can help you with this. So those are exceptionally obvious cases. There's also sometimes there's odd language within assignments. So someone talking about the separation of powers in a constitutional law assignment would be talking about the division of energy instead. Or in science assignments, eye contact is visual gaze alignment. And those are really obvious indicators that a student perhaps has not proofread their work. So there's certainly evidence that students are using AI to cheat, but it's also so important that the process is sound and that students have a voice within this process, so universities can better understand what has happened, because there is such an evolution going on in terms of assessments that are being offered, in terms of policies that are being written, and we've got to be clear with our students so everyone knows where the boundaries are.
So, Mark, you're obviously still studying. What are the kind of attitudes among your fellow students about AI?
Yeah, look, I think at the moment, and firstly, I'll just recognise what Dr. Jasmine said. I think I agree with everything that she said wholeheartedly. Some of the comments that I've been receiving from, I guess, students that I still see in contact and even around the hospitals that I work in is that everyone seems to be very much on edge when they submit an assessment, whether they have used AI or not. So when they hit that submit button and it goes through the Turnitin, which is a plagiarism detection software, not AI, that's the point when I think people's level of anxiety seems to become heightened. They're all very conscious of the fact that I haven't used AI, but I'm going to get flagged for it, or I have used AI and I'm going to get caught for it. The level of anxiety is huge out there at the moment. And I think that's one of the areas that, you know, possibly there's not going to be a solution to. I think that, you know, if you know you've done the wrong thing, you're going to get picked up. If you haven't done the wrong thing, then technically you should be okay. But I guess that's where I'm at the moment. So, yeah, I think there's definitely an elevated level of anxiety out there. I would like to quickly just touch on what Dr. Jasmine did say just with regards to the process. And I think that for me, one of the key things she said was to have that student voice and that student involvement in it, and that's where I'm disappointed that that hasn't occurred for me in what I think is an adequate way to really represent myself with somebody to sit down and to show them how I do my work. That kind of opportunity wasn't really given to me. It was all very much via email, no names on the bottom of the emails, no person to contact, no phone number. I had to go through freedom of information to get access to some of the policies and procedures, which I shouldn't have to have. You know, it was very much in cloud. And I think that's my disappointment, was that I think this could have been knocked on the head first appeal rather than being dragged out to where we are now. And I certainly do like the comment that she also made around student priority being number one. And unfortunately, I don't think that is necessarily the case in all institutions. I think that's the area that we need to work on. There's certainly technical people out there, like, you know, you've got Jasmine and Cameron, who are both very technical people by the sounds of it. You know, that's, I think, an area that they can work on. How do we technically do this? But who's looking after the student welfare? It's like, who's the non-technical person that's looking after how this makes us feel and how you can get through this, whether you've done the right or the wrong? You know, if you've used AI and you get caught, you should get caught, but there should also still be supports for you. If you haven't done it and you've been pulled up, where's the support as well?
We did contact Murdoch University. They said they don't comment on individual student cases. That is the university where Mark is studying. But they said in part, where the use of generative AI in assessments is indicated, the university takes a considered and educative approach under established academic integrity processes. Our first priority, Murdoch University said, is to support students in understanding appropriate academic practices. Where concerns arise, our processes are designed to be fair, transparent, and proportionate, with education and engagement prioritised before any punitive measures are considered. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Mark McLaughlin, a nursing student who's been caught up in an accusation by his university of using AI in an assignment. He says he didn't. Dr. Jasmine Thomas from the University of Southern Queensland, and you're about to hear from Cameron Edmund from Macquarie University, but I've also been asking you about where you think the line is in terms of AI, whether we should consider it cheating or whether we should consider it just one of the tools that people are probably going to use in their professional life anyway. One says, students using AI is like going to the gym and having a robot lift the weights for you. Cameron, you have actually made the decision to let students use AI for their essays. Talk me through your reasoning.
Yeah, g'day. Thanks so much for having me. I made this decision a couple of years ago now. I think it was 2023 when I first did this. And at the time, there was a lot of different discussions going on about should students be allowed to use generative AI. Lots of people across multiple institutes doing really strange things, in my opinion, setting traps in their assignments for generative AI detection, or doing things like using tools online to detect if generative AI was used. I did hear of one person asking ChatGPT if a student's assignment was written by ChatGPT, things like that, which, you know, as a technologist and someone with a background in this area, I knew were kind of really fraught measures, right? And not very fair on the students either. So I decided to take a different approach, which looked at finding out a bit more about how students were using AI if they were. Because the way that I saw it is using generative AI is not a kind of ethical scenario or an apolitical scenario. It has a lot of ethical baggage to it that students should be aware of. And so as a technology educator working in game development, I have that responsibility to educate my students about, okay, if you're choosing to use these tools, how are you using them? Are you using them in a good way? Using them in a bad way? What are the kind of ethical decisions about the way you're doing that? Sustainability, copyright, all sorts of problematic data sets, all sorts of things.
How did they react?
So it's been really interesting. So what I've generally said to students is just you be honest with me and kind of I'll be honest with you about this and give you some feedback. So tell me how you're using it. And because I teach in game development, we have very passionate students and students that are both technologically minded, really interested in new technologies, but also are very creative people a lot of the time. And so we have some very different opinions. Some students are very adamant that they don't want to use generative AI. For some of the reasons that, you know, some of your listeners mentioning stuff like going to the gym and having a robot do the weights for you, they're like, well, no, I want to learn how to code. I want to learn how to, you know, write my essay. I want to learn how to do whatever. Or they look at those kind of ethical problems or sustainability problems and they decide that, you know, they want to be on the other side of that. And so they choose not to use it. But then other students are using it in ways that, and why I'm glad I kind of am able to catch it in this way, is they'll be using it for things like proofreading their work or finding sources. And then they report that to me and I can look at how they're using it and I can say, well, hey, you know, you're using this tool to find sources. These are kind of the problems with doing that. It's hallucinating, or you're using it to proofread your work and it has, but it's added in these extra sentences or whatnot, you know. So, you know, maybe you want to avoid it or whatever. And I'm able to then have that honest conversation with them about it, which has been really good. So yeah, I'm seeing some students are really for it. Some students are really against it. I factor in conversations about generative AI into our ethics class discussions and other discussions in class. And it's just good to see that, you know, students have different views on it and different opinions. And that's all I really want, is for them to be thinking about their use of it.
A couple of people on the text line, uni students are saying that they use tools, a bit like what you're saying there, Cameron. One says, I use AI at uni for research, which I then fact-checked for authenticity through the university library. I use AI to proofread my assignments, check grammar and spelling, which is all approved by my uni, and I use AI to check plagiarism. I think AI becomes difficult when you write a whole assignment using it with no fact-checking and no use of your own words. Another student says, I think the guidelines are unclear. When I log into my uni, we all sign a declaration that we won't use it, but it's a broad church. I use a grammar-based AI to help me do my writing, i.e. make it active voice and tighten up readability and for summarising my notes. This person says, I'm recently diagnosed neurodivergent and this tool supports me to do the work. If I had a person in real life to help, that would be great. Well, Mark, I think your story, you've told me your personal story, but it's also, you've kind of become a lightning rod for other students in similar situations. They've gotten in touch with you and told you their stories. What are they saying?
I think it's been positive, but it's also been quite a load as well. So I'm kind of at the point now where people in hospitals or places that I go to will actually recognise me by face, which isn't always a good thing. But I guess the positive side to it is that people are talking to me about how it's affecting them personally, and that's the bit that now concerns me. I'm not going to say I've moved on. I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that the technical issues I can't deal with, and this is not something that I can solve. This is beyond my scope. But I'm hearing students, one particular student last week is kind of sitting a bit close to home. He approached me very sheepishly and said, look, I've been following what's been happening with you, and I've seen you around a few places on shifts, but I've been a bit scared to talk to you. But today I want to tell you that I've tried to commit suicide twice over this allegation that I've had over my head. Luckily, they've both been unsuccessful, but he's tried to commit suicide twice because of the additional stress that this has put on him and his family. And I think those are the areas that we're not on top of. Mm. We're really not dealing with that at all. Cameron's saying is he's allowing his students to come and talk to him freely. How we're using it, he's giving them feedback. It's there, let's use it, but let's talk about it. Let's all be adults. That's the kind of conversation that we need to have. But on a technical level, yes, and also a mental health level. How is this hurting you? What can we do to support you better through this? And that's a big concern for me. I've had international students who've been threatened to be sent home. You know, we're going to catch you for AI, and you will be sent home. I mean, how do you think those kind of comments would sit for anybody? It's just not nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And if this chat is raising issues for you, you can always call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Jasmine, I guess what I'm really hearing from Mark there is that the stakes are high for students, and the way that institutions set up their processes really has heavy implications. What do you think is the right way forward for institutions who are trying to get this right?
I think we need to engage with the complexity of AI and not just focus on that compliance mindset. So that means we need to facilitate dialogue on AI and assessment, and also our pedagogy, not just as a technical challenge, but also as an ethical dilemma. Because ultimately, universities are here for a public good. We want to produce graduates who have integrity and who are, you know, courageous and trustworthy, and our assessment systems and our processes have to support these qualities. So our students need the ability to reason and reflect and critically think and act with integrity. So I think by openly discussing AI, openly discussing the integrity aspect as well, that we're actually here to develop academic integrity. We're not just here to catch academic misconduct, which of course is required for us to uphold integrity, but have that open conversation and then be exceptionally clear with our assessment instructions and with our policies so that everyone knows what the rules are and how we can not just sort of abide by the rules, but how we can really live with that integrity.
Thank you all so much for joining me today. Nursing student Mark McLaughlin, Dr. Jasmine Thomas, Associate Professor of ICT Governance and Partnerships at the University of Southern Queensland, and Dr. Cameron Edmund, a lecturer in game development at Macquarie University School of Computing. And thank you for your thoughtful text on this as well. A lot of people who are not fans of AI, John says AI is nothing more than a stolen library. It's not intelligent. It's an automated, memory-based search engine that appropriates and devalues human knowledge and creative practice. Sarah says handwritten hard copy assignments should be the only mode permitted. Another text says we should go back to a system of exams plus oral presentations. Well, coming up here next on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, millions of Aussies work at night. So why aren't our cities designed for them?
She was every student's favourite teacher.
She would joke around with us, more like a friend than a teacher.
And I remember her saying to me that this is not goodbye, this is see you later kind of thing.
Well, if Ali is able to open up to somebody, that's a good thing.
But what began as a tension became something else.
She was brainwashing us from the start.
The Favourite, a five-part investigation into the cost of silence. Available now. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
While most of us are tucked up in bed asleep, 4 million Australians are busy at work. Nurses, cleaners, ambos, security staff, delivery drivers, bakers. These night shift workers keep things running after dark, but they're mostly invisible if you're a 9-to-5er, and to policymakers too. So what does life look like when your work day is actually a work night? Well, researchers from the University of Melbourne's Night Shift Project have been exploring that question for the last few years, and they have some thoughts on how we can better design our towns and cities for those of us who work at night. Dr. Anna Edwards has been working on this Night Shift Project. She's a research fellow in urban studies at the University of Melbourne's Centre for Cities. Anna, have you ever been a shift worker yourself?
Well, I've done lots of work in hospitality in the past, and I've also worked in shipping. So yes, I've done quite a bit of work at night, but more recently, I think kind of in the last 15 years, I've been generally a desk worker, so wow. 9-to-5.
And so you've been looking at nighttime workers, though. What did you discover were the sort of unique challenges that maybe if you are at a desk all day, you're not really thinking about?
Yeah, so what's really interesting is that night workers are not, I suppose it's not a homogenous group. There's a whole heap of different people working out there at night. However, across all of the night workers, generally, a lot of them can feel kind of socially isolated. So you kind of miss out on things like kind of family dinners, social events, kind of family bedtimes are different. You might miss out on putting your kids to bed. It can feel kind of lonely or unsafe at times. Definitely kind of public transport is a huge issue. So actually how you get to work and back, kind of if you're working in really unsocial hours, quite often it's harder than it is during the daytime and during those normal 9-to-5 times. Yeah. And there's also kind of limited access to services at night. So things like kind of pharmacies, childcare, and even trying to get a coffee late into the night can be hard to find, and something that possibly a lot of night workers want. So yeah, there's a whole heap of challenges that night workers face. I think the other important aspect to kind of another really important unique challenge that they face are kind of the health risks, which you mentioned a little bit earlier as well. Yeah.
Talk to me about the health risks here.
Yeah, so I suppose shift work kind of disrupts the circadian rhythms. So there's a whole heap of kind of health risks that have been associated with night work. So, for example, higher incidences of heart disease, diabetes, fatigue-related accidents, and poor mental health. And I think it's really interesting because you realise actually that we've known this for a long time, and yet kind of many employees who are working at night don't receive training on how to manage sleep, how to kind of manage nutrition, etc., to support and try to kind of counteract some of these potential health risks. And employers are not given the advice that they need either to be able to support their employers.
So I think there's kind of... Yeah, so keep going.
Sorry. There's a big gap, I suppose, between kind of awareness and action. So we know kind of what affects people's health at night, but current kind of workplace culture and policies haven't caught up.
I do want to talk about the specifics of what would help. I also wanted to kind of reflect on the fact that not every night shift worker is a junior worker, but I think for a lot of us, or for a lot of people who are in that space, you're doing the unsociable hours. You're sort of sometimes paying your dues a bit in a job, or you're working in a role that maybe is a bit lower paid than the typical career, and perhaps you don't have as much power as an employee to sort of push back or to ask your manager for considerations that you might need.
Yeah. I mean, there are, as I mentioned, there's a whole heap of different people working at night. So there are people on very high salaries and then people on low salaries. But I think the kind of big concern is around people on lower salaries, kind of working in precarious work, such as kind of, for example, in the gig economy. But even if you're not in the gig economy, then actually, if you're working at night, quite often you don't get to, management don't see you doing the work. Mm. And so there's kind of fewer opportunities then to, I suppose, to be kind of recognised for the work that you're doing, but also to kind of to input into company policy and to get the support that you need.
So one of the things you've looked at is structural differences, things that we can do differently in the bigger picture, governments, urban planners, making cities safer. What have you seen?
So across the world, we now know that there's more than 100 cities that have established kind of nighttime economy governance. So they have these things called night mayors, or nighttime economy managers, I think is a better better term. But
no, nightmare is perfect.
Nightmare. And yet, quite often, kind of these nightmares or kind of nighttime economy governance groups are really kind of focusing on that consumer economy, so kind of the nightlife in the city. However, we really need to start thinking about, you know, if we want wanting to activate our cities at night and create 24-hour cities, then we really need to be thinking about the people who are kind of underpinning those nighttime and 24-hour economies. I think in terms of urban planning, quite often we assume a kind of 9-to-5 city and the planning is done by people who are working in 9-to-5 jobs. So we don't actually go out and see what is happening at night. I think that's a really important point, actually, is actually if we can kind of get urban planners, people who are planning cities and designing policies to actually go out at night and see, you know, I'm not talking kind of, you know, 8 o'clock at night for dinner, but actually going out and kind of in during those early hours, middle of the night to see kind of what it's like for some of those night workers. So I think there's a whole heap of stuff that can be done. Public transport and public transport timetables, as I mentioned, I think is a really important aspect of kind of planning our cities for night workers. You mentioned kind of, you know, there's people who are on lower salaries. If there is no public transport, then people have to then drive in, pay, you know, quite expensive car parking quite often, or get an Uber or rideshare taxi, which again is very expensive. And so actually it's very important for these people to be able to get around by public transport. And at the moment I suppose the public transport timetables don't reflect 24-hour needs. I think the other thing is with planning public transport is that we don't currently know how many night workers there are within each geography. So if you're looking kind of across the city, we might know that there's 4.1 million people, Australians, who regularly work at night, and that accounts for about 1 in 3 Australian workers. So it's quite widespread. Mm. But we don't know where the hotspots of those activities are. And we can assume, you know, around hospitals and kind of industrial precincts that operate at night and nightlife districts, there might be kind of more night workers in those areas. But at the moment, we don't collect that data. So we don't actually know. There's a huge amount of work still to be done.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor speaking with Dr. Anna Edwards, who's part of the University of Melbourne Centre for Cities, looking at night shifts in Australia and what we could do differently at our city and at our economy level to support night workers. If you're a night shift worker, I'd love to know what you would like to see. One person says, I used to do night shifts at a call centre. I loved going into work at 11 p.m. on a Friday to start my shift. Felt like all of Melbourne was taking a big sigh and letting their hair down, and I was missing the rat race. And another person just says, coffee with 6 exclamation marks, which feels like a good segue into speaking to Andrew Kopolov, who's the founder of the Gig Workers Hub in Melbourne, which has since closed and is writing his PhD on it. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to set up a hub for gig workers?
So it was really a matter of just being out in the city and noticing the fact that people doing gig work, platform work, particularly people doing food delivery work, they just don't have any space, and their sort of effectively taking up space on the footpath. And also, like Anna said, it can be very isolating work, both working at night, but especially working for these platforms as well, where you become sort of quite an individual worker. Yeah.
What sort of things were you offering at the Hub?
So it was really two kind of essential things. The first thing was basic amenity. So the kind of things that a lot of employees take for granted, like having access to a staff room, you know, with toilets, a kitchen, somewhere to drink water, these kind of things. Effectively, people doing platform work go without these amenities. So we had all of those things, but the other key aspect was it was somewhere for people to gather and spend time together.
So you actually worked as a delivery driver for a couple of months. It was kind of part of your PhD research. What did you learn doing that that you weren't able to learn from running the Hub and talking to people?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I mean, as you say, I was doing it as part of my research, and there was a real difference between my experience of it and the sort of typical experience in that, for example, I wasn't reliant on this income for my livelihood. And, you know, there's a report done by the Mikkel Institute in 2023 that shows that actually more than half of food delivery riders in Australia are earning less than minimum wage. So when you're having to wait for an order and you're not getting paid for it, that has quite an effect, you know, and my experience of that time waiting was quite different. But what I will say is that having done this work, I got to meet and befriend, you know, a great number of delivery riders, and that was really what gave me the greatest insight. So it was in moments of sort of having to go and pick friends up from the hospital when they, you know, low visibility at night and they ran into a curb, or going to visit another friend who was car doored, these kind of things, yeah.
Wow. What other stories did they tell you?
Well, you know, every now and then you get hear about people being sort of disrespected by restaurant staff or customers, or just talking about, you know, there's a kind of gamified nature to these platforms. So there's a sort of constant encouragement to do as many deliveries as you can, and people just talk about sort of the strain that can put on them, yeah.
So the Hub sounded like it was amazing, but it's closed now. What happened?
Yeah, so one of the great, I guess, qualities of the Hub was that it was really worker-led. And what's important to note here is that the vast majority of people doing delivery work, as with rideshare work, they are migrants, right? And often young migrants who have arrived to Australia in recent years. So one of the great things about the Hub was that it was other young migrants who had experienced doing gig work, who with their staffing space able to speak to their peers. So when people came in who were, you know, perhaps new to the country, new to gig work, they were met with people who had been through similar experiences to them, not only in the work, but also in terms of things like dealing with visa uncertainty and so on. Now, the flip side of that was that being run by precarious migrant workers, the team had a lot of other priorities. And that was kind of one of the main issues, was that we just weren't able to keep it going because of our own capacities. But then, of course, other things like issues around maintaining funding, sustainability of the financial model as well. Yeah.
I do want to talk about what employers or cities can do to support these. On the text line, Kate says, I worked day shift for 2 weeks, then afternoon shift for two, then midnight to 8 a.m. for 2 weeks for many years in a computer centre. I loved it. We were supplied with taxis home at night and taxis to work for the midnight shift. We were so well looked after. So, Anna, I'd love to know, we've got Kate on one hand with a pretty unsociable schedule, but able to really appreciate it. And then we've got what Andrew's seen on the other hand with the gig economy. What do employers and cities need to be doing to best support folks?
Yeah, so I think kind of cross-sector coordination is essential. So I think kind of the city planners, the transport authorities, the employers need to work with the employees to kind of to understand kind of what the solutions are that are needed on the ground. As I mentioned, there's kind of a lot of governments have, or city governments in particular, have established 24-hour economy kind of models or strategies or put people in place to manage these. And I think we need to kind of think about night workers as part of those strategies and what they're doing, not just for hospitality, but as you mentioned, kind of for health, logistics, cleaning, etc. As Andrew mentioned, I think kind of not just for gig workers, but we need kind of safe rest areas, accessible spaces, things like toilets, amenities, etc. for people who are working at night, which perhaps kind of daytime workers take for granted. Improving late night transport. I think also kind of thinking about safety. So we have done kind of quite a bit of work with an organisation called Not So Hospitables, kind of looking into kind of, for example, sexual harassment in within hospitality, which is a huge issue. So there's so much that can be done. I think what I'd really like to see, and something that I personally found very, very useful, very interesting, was we spoke to 17 night workers who work in city operations at the City of Adelaide. And so they're the people who kind of sweep the streets and kind of make it nice for the next day, kind of look after the horticulture. And actually, I'd recommend kind of in terms of local councils that that people go out and talk to those people who look after the streets at night, because those people had a huge knowledge and understanding of what the streets look like at night, kind of who moves around the city, some of the challenges, and also their night workers themselves, so they can kind of give feedback on what they would like to see in their cities. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done. I think it would also be helpful to have things like health checks. So so government or employers providing health checks for night workers, considering we know that there are health risks associated with working at night, and I think also guidance on how to manage working at night as well. So kind of, there's a huge amount of research that medical research that's I'm not a medical research, but yeah. Medical research that's been undertaken kind of to understand night work. And there's a lot of findings that could be used to support and provide better guidance.
Well, Anna and Andrew, thank you both so much for sharing your knowledge. Dr. Anna Edwards is a research fellow in urban studies at the University of Melbourne's Centre for Cities. Anna worked on the Night Shift Research Project. And Andrew Kopolov founded the Gig Workers Hub in Melbourne and is currently completing his PhD on it. Up next here on Life Matters, how long would you stand in line to buy something you really wanted?
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Andy Griffiths.
He ended up at the centre of the earth fighting the peanut butter beast.
Now, Ben O'Cree.
Put their hands up if they have never been brokenhearted.
The changing nature of performance and recording in Australia.
From books to music and far beyond,
the arts are just one way Radio National
explores the world in full.
Have you heard about the tiny bakery in Sydney that's supposedly selling cinnamon scrolls that are to die for? There's one problem. Every weekend, there's a line of people that stretches down the road and around the corner. And I need you to know something about me. I don't queue for basically anything. Are cinnamon scrolls, any cinnamon scrolls, worth a one-hour wait? If you're asking me, probably not. Yet people still do it. So does the act of queuing for hours to buy something increase the thrill when you finally get it? Or does it mean you're destined for disappointment? Well, with me is Dr. Paul Harrison, a senior lecturer in marketing at Deakin Business School. He joins me for our regular buyer beware chat. Paul, are you a queuer?
Yes, I am.
Oh.
And I think, I mean, you are a queuer, Tegan, but maybe not voluntarily.
Yes, not by choice, for sure.
Exactly. Because I was thinking, as we were talking about, we queue for security at the airport, we queue in all sorts of ways, but I do voluntarily queue. And I think it's part of my, I don't know, behavioural anxiety in that I like to get good things. And I think one of the things is that queuing is one of these elements where when you're in a queue, the uncertainty is removed away from you into, I guess, a form of extrinsic reality. I mean, I've queued for things like, you know, this is, I don't want to sound like a, you know, person who travels too much, but, you know, a croissant in Paris. Or I did queue for tickets for the BBC proms one year. Okay. And the Mahler Festival that I went to, again, I queued 2 years in advance for tickets. So it's partly about what's important to people, but there is a lot more going on in terms of the psychology of queuing than purely just lining up and saying, I'll just wait to get what I need.
I think, so you mentioned security lines at the airport. Yes, definitely that's a thing that we all have to queue for if we travel. I feel like queuing is less of a thing, it's less of part of our lives these days than it used to be, at least physically standing in line. Back in the day, if you wanted to see your favourite band in concert, you might have gone and slept out overnight in front of the ticket office to you know, get your ticket, whereas now we just curse the website as it fails to load and tells you that you're like 8,000th in the queue. Do you think there's something about the fact that queuing isn't as much of a part of our lives now that makes things like queuing for a croissant more of a novelty?
I think part of it is the performance. I mean, we all know that life is a series of performances. Now, some of us post it on social media, but other people actually like the collective experience of queuing, because I think that's the other thing, is that we forget that there are less opportunities for us to be social. And one of the really, I guess, human elements, the psychological elements of queuing, is that when you're in a queue with other people, there's a kind of, I guess, a collective effervescence, this idea that you're kind of joined together in this thing. And again, people use it as a form of self-justification as well. Like, now that I'm here and I'm waiting, it must be worth it. If all of these people are here, it must be worth it. Somebody's done the due diligence. We're all lining up for this amazing cinnamon bun or something like that. So it must be good. And again, that removes some of that, I guess, that risk. We put trust in the crowd. And these are opportunities that we have less of because we spend so much time online. I mean, we know at a kind of, I guess, a basic level that we're in a queue, but that queue isn't human. It's an algorithm and it's pushing us through, where when you're with people, there is this sense of social connection and people are joining together in a bigger act.
I do love this idea of the kind of implied due diligence, that if the queue is there, then value is implied. Does it affect our perception of the final product when we finally get to the beginning of the queue, if we sort of feel like we've earned it?
Yeah, it does. And there's quite a lot of research that's kind of looked at that, is that actually queuing, actually forcing ourselves to wait for something, actually then leads us to feel what basically a sense of high utility of that. And it's because it's delayed satisfaction in a way. So what we do is that we get into this crowd, we see what's going on, we see what people are doing, we get excited by it, we join in amongst the camaraderie that's going on in the queue. And then what we do is that we kind of feel like a sense of achievement. It's like the IKEA effect. That's an actual psychological effect. What? Which is, it feels like we've put effort into something and we're getting what we need, and therefore we actually feel a higher level of connection to the thing that we've queued for.
It's the IKEA effect, like if I've wielded an Allen key, I'm more happy with my furniture. Okay.
Yes, and if also, you know, you've had a fight or something like that, because there's been an emotional kind of response to that. IKEA, I don't know whether they engineered it that way, but they've kind of created this idea, and it's built around this idea of, if we put a bit of effort into something, we tend to have a higher level of ownership. There's a theory called prospect theory, which basically tells us the more effort we put into something, the more we feel connected to it, the more we're kind of the less willing we are to give it up. And that's, queuing is an example of that. Travelling to stand in a queue, wait an hour for a cinnamon bun, you know, ultimately the cinnamon bun is just, you know, a few ingredients put together, but it is that kind of idea of, look at all the work I've put in trying to get this.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Dr. Paul Harrison. He's a consumer behaviour expert who joins me fortnightly for our segment that we call Buyer Beware. Today, we are talking about queuing, especially for viral things. Bettina says, I queue for tickets to anything dark mofo related. Its events are always unforgettable and brilliant, totally worth it. Plus, their system is great. great. You know where you are in the queue at all times. Another says, I have just returned from Japan and they are the queuing capital of the world, very disciplined and polite. Paul, what are the sort of logistics of a queue? How can you make a queuing experience a good one if you are the vendor?
Yeah, I think part of it is helping exactly what the what your texter just said about actually letting you know what's going on. So a queue itself can be unsettling because you don't know where where you stand in the queue. So constantly updating people about how long the queue is, how long it will take them to get where they need to. Probably one of my best security experiences I've ever had was in Amsterdam, where it had technology, and even if this technology wasn't telling the truth, it made me feel like I was safe. So it would tell me how long I had to wait, which was the fastest moving queue. It would direct me towards it. So it wasn't a person guessing, this queue is going fast. It was using, in inverted commas, technology. Mm. I think Disney have done a really good job of that at their theme parks. One of the things that they do is that they basically use very clear signage. They have visible progress. They reframe the waiting as anticipation. So they have music and people performing, engaging people, transforming that delay into, a prelude to the actual full experience. So rather than making queuing, a bad experience, making it part of the experience is a really clever way to remove that anxiety and that stress that people get from queuing.
Is there a difference in the experience of queuing for something fun, like a cinnamon scroll, or queuing for something like there aren't enough checkout operators at the supermarket?
Yes, there is. And again, I guess there's a degree of sitting underneath that, which is how critical it is to this person's kind of what the person is trying to buy or they're trying to do. So I think one of the things is that if we feel, again, you can still control that, and all emotion and all responses have different levels of valence, I guess. But one of the ways to think about that is that if ultimately there's going to be a queue, and we're kind of, probably talking about something like a supermarket, if people can still see that there's some sense of order, that there is, a form of procedural justice, people are going to find that more positive or certainly see it as something contributing to a better experience than if it just all feels ad hoc and random and then they suddenly change the way that it's set up. We have this kind of element of our kind of human reasoning, which is bounded rationality. We really don't have the ability to look at all complex decisions. So what we do is that we look to others to help us to kind of manage that. If they also look like they're out of control and they have no idea what they're doing, it does have a much more negative effect. I'm always surprised, with these supermarkets, how much effort and research they put into the design of the actual supermarket itself, but hardly anything into the way that they do queuing. And that can have a huge impact on people's satisfaction.
Paul, thanks so much for joining me. Dr. Paul Harrison is a senior lecturer in marketing at Deakin Business School. And I was hoping one of these texts would come through. Matt says, my wife and I met in a queue. She pushed in front of me in a line for fish and chips. It was a very long queue ahead of us, so I decided to have a chat instead of asking her to move to the back. Clearly, the rest is history here. Another says, what about queuing for the ladies' toilets? Many a problem has been solved in those queues. Well, that's true.
Christopher Skase. You might remember that name. The high-flying businessman turned fugitive. You may even remember parts of the Skase saga, like this.
Andrew Denton's chase for Skase.
Or this.
Enrolls Skase in a wheelchair with an oxygen mask.
Well, now you can get your head around the full story. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you so much for your texts. A lot of opinions about queuing today. One says, a simple maxim, not much is worth queuing for, but once I'm in a queue, I welcome the opportunity for conversation. Lately, I've been breaking the ice with what's worse, people who leave bits of Vegemite in the butter or people who leave bits of butter in the Vegemite. Everyone has an opinion eventually. Sharon says queuing can indeed kickstart relationships, sometimes lifelong. Not my story, but the story of two friends. In the 1980s, they were queuing to enrol for their first year classes at university. They were standing next to each other in the queue. In the long time it took to enrol, they chatted and decided to move out of their respective homes, move together into a share home, and it was the start of their decades-long friendship. I learnt this story of friendship at the funeral of one of these women. Well, that is it for Life Matters today on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow, the number of foster carer families has been dropping across all states and territories over the last 5 years. Things like cost of living pressures, low carer allowances, and carers feeling undervalued. It's all adding up to a system that's letting down carers and vulnerable children. So what needs to change? That's tomorrow here on Life Matters. Catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.